From Sylvain Labs, welcome to Critical Nonsense. On our show, we dig deep into cultural ephemera and pose questions to each other to inspire interesting conversations. This is Critical Nonsense. This week, Aaron asks Joey about drag culture, and Joey asks Aaron about movie sequels.
Woo! Important information. This is what a Joey sounds like.
And this is what an Aaron sounds like.
And this is what executive producer and axolotl enthusiast Jess sounds like.
Hi, this is Jess.
Okay.
Welcome, everybody, to Critical Nonsense. Yeah, we are here in the stewed.
Is that what we're going with now?
For now. Thank you. That's Heaven and Tracy over at BuzzFeed.
We're going to go to the co-op.
Yeah, we're going to.
Quad.
And with very small, what's the leafy green? Kale. It's the only leafy green. That's why it's the leafy green. But anyway, this is where we are. This is how our conversation is. Absolutely. Yo, a U-turn is the only turn. You know, so this week, you know, the thing that's been on my mind is my weekend plans. So what are you doing this weekend, Joey?
Baby planning.
Yay! I'm going to be doing something very similar, which is going to Comic-Con.
Identical.
And not to be confused with baby planting, which is a very different
yeah.
Extremely.
Activity. I also like baby plants.
Yes. Oh, God. Like baby cucumbers. Are they a thing, Jess? Are they a thing?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to run with it. I like a Cornichon. Basically a baby
that's
cucumber
a
that's pickled.
Okay.
No, I mean, they're, you know, family.
Oh my God, family.
Family. it's a very vegetable family. So this weekend.
This is totally coming out.
It may. So this weekend is Comic-Con. Super excited about it. Heading out there. Gonna, you know, figure out what cosplay situation comes out of my personal costume box.
You still don't have a costume prepared? You're just going in blind?
A little bit. So, you know, I've gone a number of years and it's con season. It's my husband and I's kind of thing to go to these different cons. And there's, you know, New York Comic Con is its own thing. Of course, San Diego Comic Con was the original. But
Con-Con.
Con-Con is a thing.
Yeah, for jailbreakers.
Yeah, wait, for jailbreakers?
People okay. Just pulling long cons. That's what I was assuming.
Okay, I think I just agreed too quickly. I thought I remembered Con-Con being a thing.
Oh, were you thinking of Genghis Con-Con? Because that's a different con.
I hope everybody just like sighed as much as I did. But, you know, given that it is con season, there was one other con last weekend, which is RuPaul's Drag Con. And it's a big deal. It's actually in its third year. Started in L.A. It's in New York. And drag is huge. I mean, drag is enormous culturally right now, and it's building quite a bit. But in any case, you know, this has been sort of swimming around in my head for a bit and has led me to a really specific question. Can drag survive the mainstream?
I think the short answer to can anything survive mainstream culture is no. I think the longer answer is yes, and it's more about which parts of drag are going to survive as opposed to can drag holistically survive. Anything that goes into mainstream culture is not going to look like it does today, right? Mainstream culture is a cherry picker that is just saying this part's fun, this part's not, this part doesn't make sense to me, I don't get the nuance of this, and, you know, we're going to look back in 10 years and 5-year-olds are going to be yelling yes queen at each other and it's going to be wonderful. And
I
no
like
one's
five
gonna
years
know
from
why.
Now is very similar to 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It's very good. Well, what do you mean by mainstream culture?
I guess I'm thinking of it from the sort of ethnocentric perspective of the United States and thinking about sort of broadly, you know, democratize things, ideas that are sort of pervasive across the United States. And I don't think it has to be for everyone, right? Like you're still going to have regional cultures and things like that. But like what things get taken away, right? Like obviously mainstream culture is a little bit of maybe it would attend Con-Con because it likes stealing, right?
Yeah.
like you that. Like what I did there? I just like brought that. It all the way
that
back.
Was real good.
All the way back to 3 minutes ago. but I think it's about mainstream culture steals, right? Like some aspects of ideas because it's pulling from so many subcultures, right? Like a little bit here, a little bit there. It is like a melange, right? A melting pot. And I think it is the thing that we all share as some group, right? So mainstream right, in this right. case is what does the large group of the United States share?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I honestly struggle with this a lot. The question of what actual the mainstream is or what pop culture is. I think we talked a little bit about pop music last week and whether pop music is a good definition of any genre. And it's kind of, it's a question about whose gaze gets to be promoted the most. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically in that common fabric that, at least in this context, Americans all share. Who are the selectors of, you know, all of those different cultural artifacts that get blended together?
Mm-hmm.
And then we say, this is the mainstream. And with,
can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Is there one drag culture?
Oh, that's such a good question.
Because you're talking about it as if it's one thing, and I'm not part of drag culture, so I don't know it intimately, right? Like,
true.
I can see it from the outside, but is it one thing? That seems a little reductive too, right?
Absolutely. And I think our listeners will definitely clock me as an armchair drag expert, which is when you throw expert on there, I'm a drag fan. I'm a gay man in my 30s that goes to gay bars in New York. So let's like frame it that way. But there are tons of different drag cultures, drag subcultures. I think when we talk about there's one question or one designation, which is all about different types of queens. We've got bio queens. We've got
what's a bio queen?
So a bio queen is a cisgender woman who amplifies their presentation, their female presentation.
Lady Gaga.
Lady Gaga could be considered a bio queen if she identified it and did performances as a bio queen. But yes, I think that is I find that a helpful proxy. There are trans queens. Not all queens, of course, are defined just by the gender that they identify as.
Mm-hmm.
There are scare queens, goth queens. Mm-hmm. The list kind of goes on and on. There's just gender fuck in general, which is really making people question or really break out what it is that gender expression should be. So you blend traditional signals of masculine and feminine and bring out androgyny, which of course has been in sort of the high fashion scene for decades. But all of those different types of queens don't necessarily all exist in their own subcultures, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even at its basic, you see subcultures that are divided by race, like the black queen culture, the Latina queen culture. Those are very different from even what I would call mainstream queen culture, which is what Drag Race has developed.
So you've also shifted in this to talk about queen culture instead of drag culture. And I don't know if they're interchangeable because I'm on the outside. So are they the same or are they different? Or
I'm using them synonymously.
Got it.
However, I do think that there's a question about drag in general being broader, right? Because drag kings, cis women, but presentations of hypermasculinity, basically, as their own performance vector, definitely a thing. What has struck me is that with Drag Race in particular, RuPaul's Drag Race is in its 10th season. A couple of years ago, it moved over from Logo to VH1. They just wrapped up season 10, 3 All-Stars seasons, 2 spinoffs. They had 489,000 viewers they averaged 489,000 viewers per episode in their last season, which for cable is outstanding, right?
Yeah.
Like, and almost
a gold record.
Which Rue has many of. I mean, she has created tons of music that, and all the queens that come off the show have their own YouTube series and like
brands
wow.
Yeah.
Yes. Like it is a cottage industry that has moved again from being this underground, underappreciated performance art to being something that now a lot of young women are buying into, mm-hmm. which was a lot of why it moved to VH1 too, right? Like, you've got a very different audience base from Logo, which is the original LGBT network. I put an asterisk over LGBT because really, I think they were just leaning into the G, but that's a whole different story. Moving from there to VH1, which had a much broader audience base and appealed to a perfect cross segment of their programming.
So when you're talking about can drag culture survive, what does survival mean to you? Because, you know, I'm thinking about right now, you know, from Paris is Burning, which was, you know, it was in the 80s, that sort of, in 70s, that sort of Harlem, South ball Bronx, culture,
absolutely.
Ball culture, voguing, like all of that, you know, drag culture today is not the same as it was at that point. Granted, there are bits of it that have survived, but it's evolved to fit the current times, right? Like the things that queens are doing today versus then are very different, and they've kind of picked and choose what they loved, right? Like catcalling, dancing, mm-hmm. presenting, like all of those things are still part of the culture, but it's evolved. And so if the question is about can drag survive as it is today, then definitively it's definitely no, right? Right.
Yeah.
But there are other cultures that sort of enter the mainstream, and there's still this sort of sacred, hallowed group, or a group that is identified as sort of the driving force of that culture that is separate, smaller, and more credible, or, you know, sort of owns the culture, even though it exists in the mainstream. I mean, it's the difference between Drake and Kendrick, maybe, right? Mm. You know, like Drake is mainstream, and in some ways Kendrick is mainstream, but he's not presenting himself in order to be the mainstream representation of hip hop. He has stayed so tight in for what he's trying to be about, what his messages are, who he's talking to. And if other people want to pick up on it, great. I'm sure he's still happy to cash those checks. But
there's a question. Do you think that Kendrick, as a Pulitzer Prize winner, is mainstream? Like, is the Pulitzer Prize a mainstream award and a designation of success in a mainstream or traditional architecture?
I think it might be mainstream in journalism or academia or some of these other arenas that it exists. I think it's sort of mainstream for intellectuals, maybe.
Well, I got mine last week.
Yeah, I just got mine in the mail. I ordered it, and
I mean, it fell out of a Lucky Charms box.
Also, but my publisher's clearinghouse came in. I think I'm gonna win this year.
I'm rooting for you. I'm rooting.
Jess
for
has
you.
No idea what publisher's clearinghouse is.
Is it a publisher?
Ooh.
Is it a clearinghouse? These are the two options that I have.
Have you ever seen a giant check?
I mean, the other thing, I do want to take a quick pause because you hit on something that I have to amplify, which is Paris is Burning. Mm. So Paris is Burning is a movie, came out. It was directed by Jenny Livingston in 1990, and it is credited as the popularizing force of drag culture. Mm-hmm. Or I should say the documentary window that allowed many people to better understand ball culture specifically.
Mm-hmm. What's ball culture?
Ball culture is, to double down on that. So ball culture is a specific Black and Latino form of drag, a community, houses that are made that have kind of chosen families within them. This has been around, of course, well before 1990 and in the mm-hmm. 80s, which is why it was popularized in the movie.
But effectively, like competitive dancing.
Competitive,
right?
Yes. There's lots of competition, lots of community support as well. And it's a very specific and strong form of drag. Again, Pose, which is a TV show that came out this year on FX, directed by Ryan Murphy, who apparently was my favorite Ryan a little while ago.
Yeah.
Must watch. Really empathetic and beautiful portrayal of that scene, updated. It feels like Paris is Burning. It came back to life. say all that because you had drag culture in the 1890s. You had it in vaudeville. You had drag culture in the 1950s swirling around New York's Mattachine Society, which was a group of, you know, upper class white gay men who got together and said, we can be gay quietly together, but we're not really going to accept drag queens because that's too far out there. There's a lot of complicated politics in there, but there have been many different iterations of what a drag culture has been and different fragmentations that have fallen out of it. So admittedly, can it survive the mainstream? Perhaps it's better thought of as what iteration is truest to the intentions of the original culture, which is not just about performance, but about a sort of performative resistance.
I think you also have to look at it from the lens of, you know, you're someone who is closer to this culture, like you were talking about. You're a gay man in his 30s in New York City, you know, arguably one of the centers of drag, if not the center of modern drag.
The right? Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence in San Francisco would have a very different perspective, but please continue.
Got it. One of, yes. But you're looking at this from the perspective of someone inside of it. And I think when you're talking about can it survive the mainstream, as someone outside of it, the perspective is going to be what of this culture speaks to me? What aspects of this do I like? Because that's going to be what happens, right? The mainstream culture is going to say, I like that. I get it. This part doesn't make sense to me. Take it or leave it. Right. You know, like that's inevitably what happens when cultures cross. You take the parts that fit with your identity. You take the parts that speak to you in some way that are exciting or fun or allow you a new vector for communicating yourself. Right. And so that's why you see sort of, and I don't even know the appropriate language, so tell me, but like what I call like the yelling positivity, or like the calling type of aspect, you know, of like the Yas Queens and tea and like these ideas, right? These phrases that people are starting to use.
Spilling all that tea.
Spilling that tea. Give her tea.
I refuse to explain spilling the tea. You guys are just going to have to look that up.
Okay. But I think that like what you're seeing is sort of that loud, boisterous positivity that is part of drag coming through. You're seeing literally the phrase drag 'em. Mm-hmm. Right. Also, like sort of the loud, catty negativity. I don't know how to talk about that concept, but like those things are coming out because it's allowing people to communicate better. And that's what the mainstream is taking right now. I don't know what else will come out of it. And drag will continue. The culture will iterate and, you know, inevitably new things will come up. But drag will survive mainstream culture, but mainstream culture will bastardize what drag is at its heart and just take the parts that it likes.
I couldn't have put it better myself.
Solved it. So I've been thinking a lot about sequels, about reboots, about sort of this serialization that we're getting in movie and cinema. And
why?
And my question for you is, are sequels a problem or are sequels just sort of inevitable? So I don't know if you have an immediate answer from just that question.
I do. There's so, I mean, okay, knee jerk, I gotta go. It's problematic. You know, I love me a good blockbuster. I love sitting down at a movie theater that has the seats that recline, where you get to have like a little bit of food. Like, I mean, shout out to Alamo Drafthouse.
Yeah. I went to a theater in New Hampshire with my parents to see some big sequel movie, and it had like a full giant ass Lazy Boy.
Yes.
With like drink holders, and I was like, this is the most comfortable I've ever been watching a movie.
Absolutely.
Take my $17.50.
And that's how they got it from me for a lot of original big blockbuster movies. The sequels, I can watch on a flight. I can get them later on. I feel as though it stifles broad spread creativity.
So let me pose something to you.
Pose
for your mind grapes.
Oh, they're squishing, make my mind wine.
Mind wine. I'm stuck on that now. I forgot exactly what I was going to say. I'm just drinking this mind wine. So the business model of cinema has changed radically.
Yeah.
True. I mean, both in the 21st century, but then in the past 4 years, it has changed radically, right? Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, all of these places making sort of premier cinema has changed things.
Yeah.
But the other part of, I was listening to an interview with Matt Damon earlier. Matt Damon.
There it is. Okay.
earlier this week. And he was talking about how the market for mid-range films has almost completely dried up because of the business model that these film production companies are using, right? So from $20 million to $80 million, it's completely dried up because they're saying, we're going to have to double that no matter what to promote the movie anyways. Mm-hmm. So even if we give you $20 million, we're going to have to spend another $20 million on advertising and promotion and all of this stuff. And all of a sudden that sort of double your investment to promote a film doesn't make sense anymore. And so what you're inevitably is happening is they'll give you $4 million for a film and maybe you get some residuals on the back or you get some points on that package. Mm-hmm. But now you have that was the area where people were getting experimental with film, you know? And so now because the business model is broken, they've kind of cut out that opportunity for being risky. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was because if you put out a movie in that range, you are making a ton of money on the back end. In that interview, he said someone told one of the, you know, heads of a studio told him that we lost half of our business because we don't sell DVDs anymore.
Wow. I mean, it is shocking to me how expensive it is to produce a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Watching the credits for the Avengers, the latest Avengers Infinity War, that is as long as the movie in and of itself.
Yeah.
And the number of units that they had to have, the amount of course post-work that needed to happen, I had a much better appreciation, for example, for why it costs so much to make such a big movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, would you consider things like Avengers Infinity War is very specific, but mm-hmm. let's say the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where mm-hmm. you have characters that are crossing lots of different films. Would you put that in the same bucket as a sequel or a reboot?
Yeah, so it's a good question because I printed out a list that we have in front of us that is all of the sequels in 2017, and the list is 44 major feature release films in 2017 that were sequels, which is just kind of bonkers, right? Yeah. Like, and some of these, the world maybe needed, need might be a strong word, but did the world need The Mummy?
Oh, don't do that. Did if Brendan Fraser was back. Yeah. Fraser.
Did the world need 50 Shades Darker?
Okay, that I have a different opinion on, because that soundtrack is banging.
Soundtrack is great. So maybe just for the soundtrack, we'll accept that hot pile of steaming garbage.
Yes. I mean, and even Jumanji, right? Where we had like...
The world didn't need Jumanji.
It didn't. It was perfect on its own. I hear the drums in my head right now.
Yeah. Do we need Bad Moms too? Bad Moms was bad.
Ooh, yeah. They didn't. No. Well, but you know, it had a place in the world. It had a place to justify making a sequel. The other thing that you actually point out though is that there is a difference between making an animated feature a sequel versus a live action sequel, because you do have a lot of sunk costs that go into all of the modeling and CGI work to make Cars. So why not make a Cars 2 and a Planes and an every other mode of transit film that are all not good?
But I think it still winds up coming back to that question of what is the business model that these companies are in? Mm-hmm. And they got the chair kicked out from under them, right? And now all of a sudden they're saying, how do we make money when we don't know how to make money? Yeah. Right? And so that's why I think you're getting a lot of these reboots as well, which is on this list, right?
Like, absolutely.
You know, Beauty and the Beast live action. We have I don't know if either of you saw Beauty and the Beast live action.
Yes, actually, we sing it at home a lot.
Like, was it good?
It was shockingly good. Shockingly, because you don't expect the reboots to be good.
Yeah, but I think in those examples, what you're actually, or it, right, which was everyone has said it was good. I think the reason you're getting that is because there's sort of the risk reward conversation that these studios are having, and how do we mitigate risk? People know these characters, they're familiar. If we can make it shiny enough, we can get, you know, our return on investment from this production. And so they're afraid to try and create new characters. There's sort of that other question, right, of how many stories are there, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was that book of, like, there was a book, there was like, there's 8 or 12 stories. We can put it in the show notes after, but it's like, there are 8 stories. Like, hero returns home to find home destroyed and wreaks vengeance. Like, that type of story, aka John Wick,
yep.
Which was also rebooted.
But also, when you think about it as a commercial argument, yes, it's studios who are only willing to reinvest in properties they already have.
Mm.
But still, the only people we have to blame are us, the viewers, who keep going back no matter how much we keep saying, I'm not going to go watch that. Like, how much time? Actually, another place where the industry has changed dramatically is trailers.
Mm.
Like, the trailer industry and the agencies that exist just to create trailers exploded over the past 10 years. And it's all because of YouTube. I know that I spend enough time.
There are examples, and I, you know, I'm not in the industry, so we can check back later and maybe we'll throw something. But there, I've heard discussions about how, like, this movie died because the trailer was terrible.
Absolutely.
And then it, like, has a resurgence as, like, a cult movie after, mm-hmm. because the movie was actually good and they just had a shit trailer. But
this was the case a year ago, I think, with Millie Bobby Brown and the new Godzilla film, because they premiered a trailer at Comic-Con, which is why I think it was a year ago. And in the trailer, they just used footage that had a boom mic in the background or something, and the internet went crazy. They could not get past anything about the story, anything about the content that was shown in it, because you saw the guy in the background. However, they did release...
Key grip.
Yeah. Bob, come on now. Yeah. But...
He's union. He's safe.
The new trailer came out. I think it's going to be great. And Millie Bobby Brown is like a queen. So, but I go back again to my question about Marvel. I can't get away from it. So you've got...
Logan was dope.
Logan was really good. Logan was really good.
Like, that was a legitimately amazing story. So that's part of it. Like, I want to have attachment to characters, but I want these sequels or reboots to not be cheap and thoughtless, right? And some of these here are legitimately good, right, on this list. Like, Logan was legitimately good. There's an argument to be had for John Wick 2 because people really attached to John Wick.
That argument, huh?
The return of Xander Cage, triple X, whatever number triple X this is,
yeah,
the world didn't need.
I would argue against that. We always need Xander Cage. And that, okay, so super producer and baby cucumber enthusiast Jess just pointed out Spider-Man, right? We've gone through at least 3 Spider-Men in the past 20 years.
Yeah.
We've gone through our...
My favorite was Spider-Man 3.
I'm
lying. That was terrible.
It was really bad. Yeah. Sam Raimi doing a big oopsie-daisy right on the screen. But we did have... We had our Tobey Maguire moment, we had our Andrew Garfield moment, and now we've got our Tom Holland moment. And arguably, the Tom Holland moment
I love me some Tom Holland.
He's really good.
That's what I'm saying.
I need to not yo as much. That was an amazing... Spider-Man Homecoming is a solid film.
It's fantastic.
And it's the most authentic to the story that they wanted to tell in the comic books.
I wish we didn't have to just keep watching the same he turns into Spider-Man film.
Yes.
I really enjoyed the movie, but why do we have to have the origin story for the third time? We know how it happens.
Which is why you got to play Spider-Man PS4.
Yeah, cut through it. Okay, he's a Spider-Man now. Great. Like, let's start doing something.
Yes.
But I agree that is sort of the best film, and like having that ability to do iterative creativity and maybe, you know, getting crushed online for what a pile of hot garbage Sam Raimi produced with Spider-Man 3.
Yeah.
Which one was Jamie Foxx in? That was in the second iteration, second film.
Yes, that was Andrew Garfield's sequel.
I didn't watch it, but...
However, I'm not going to... The other piece of this, it's not just TV, or not just movies, it's TV too. I mean, we have been going through this with Will and Grace, with the Connors and Roseanne and all of that. And it does feel like it's less so a question about can we see the same story again, and more so the comfort of revisiting a story that we know, but hopefully having like the modern, updated, fresh perspective that we need to really appreciate it.
Yeah.
And it just keeps on. It's a real crapshoot whether or not that actually works. And sequels do not do that well.
Yeah. I mean, the world is changing. I mean, we talked about this last week. The world is changing really fast. I mean, how fast is technology changing, and what an incredible role that it plays in our life now. You're rebooting stories to just fit the contemporary time, right? Like
yes.
the first Tobey Maguire Spider-Man as an example versus the new iteration of Spider-Man. The world is quite different, right?
Like absolutely. The trailer, if you recall, the first trailer for the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man had a helicopter stuck between the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
And it was released the summer. That trailer came out in the summer of 2000. So they, of course, cut the scene from the film. And all of 2000. Yeah, it was actually 2000, even though the film came out 2001. But yeah, like the world is completely different. The stories have to be completely different. Yeah. And maybe that's part of it, that we don't have enough perspective when you do a sequel 2 years later to be able to provide fresh perspective.
Yeah, I mean, if you look backwards, like very far backwards, like how many stories, plays, whatever were done about Julius Caesar? Like ultimately, sort of the one Shakespeare version survived over time, but like how many stories were done about, you know, Henry VIII? How many stories are done, and they're constantly rebooted? Like it makes sense to retell stories based on a new perspective or whatever, or if you are somehow attached to a particular character.
Or I think, if Kenneth Branagh is anywhere nearby.
Yes.
He should be.
Yes. But I think like there is sort of this peak nostalgia moment that we're going through too, and I question whether that's part of this. I think we've gotten better at doing sequels, like Logan as an example, where it's, he is older. It is sort of, we've serialized him as a character for a long time, and now we're kind of literally putting, you know, the stake in the ground to say this is the last film that, you know, we're going to do with Logan. This is how the story ends. And I really like that component of it.
Spoiler alert.
It was a thinly veiled spoiler alert, but...
But then
Can guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the film opens with, I'm dying.
Well, that's a spoiler. Yeah. Well, we're really going to have to put a spoiler alert in front.
Yeah. But I think like that Logan is sort of an interesting example where they've done, you know, he must be in 10 films probably at this point.
Yeah.
And he showed up. There was an evolution, a story arc over those 10 films. And at the end of it, he dies.
Yeah.
And that's kind of fantastic.
So
Jess is going to throw up right now from spoiler alert.
No, I just have to say, you know what that reminded me of is how for those who watch The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, it's kind of a twisted, serialized sequel-like thing as well, because you bring back the people who didn't find love and then you just put them all on an island together and see what drama unfolds. Yeah. It's like Logan. It's like the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Is The Bachelor actually just about the host? Like, are we... Chris, what's his name?
Oh, I don't even know.
Chris something, the host of The Bachelor.
I am proud to say I do not know the answer to this question.
Don't be proud.
What if The Bachelor is just a story about him and we're just watching him age season to season and at the end he dies?
Yeah. This is basically The Bachelor / Logan. Yeah. But I do love the idea that actually that certain reality shows, it illuminates two things. Those reality shows where you bring back people over and over again, it's a logical business move. You've got eyeballs on those people. They're recognizable to your target audience.
You're attached.
Yeah. Why would you throw them out? Like, nah, bring them back. People want to see those people and see where they've gone. And then also, I don't know how many seasons we're at The Bachelor. We're at least 12, certainly.
Maybe way higher. We're like 20.
I think I am a little bit behind. I must get back to
and
a few
of those.
And
that's not including The Bachelorette.
True.
Which add like another 20.
And it goes back to your point about specific stories that have always been told. We've seen multiple seasons that have happened of The Bachelorette and The Bachelor already within that series.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like Russian roulette. You want to see which one's going to happen this time.
Yeah.
Am I going to get season 2 again? Or am I going to get season 10?
When do we get Gay Bachelor or Lesbian Bachelorette?
So we had it. It was on Logo. It was called Boy Meets Boy. It was awful. It was so bad. And we had it again not too long ago. It
we need that Chris trash. Guy, because that's what it turns out everyone's just attached to him.
Wait, Chris Hardwick? Chris Pratt? Which Chris?
It's a different Chris. I don't know the host.
That guy, that Chris. Yeah. So then the answer to your question then, Joey, is we don't quite know, but we're going to find out at Bad Moms Christmas.
Oh, you just ended on such a downer. Bad Moms Christmas.
We'll let you guys decide whether that was a downer, but this has been Critical Nonsense.
Eggnog.
Critical Nonsense was recorded in MacGyver Studios in beautiful New York, New York.
It is a Sylvain Labs production.
Special thanks to sound engineer Alex Contel.
Special thanks to impeccable friendship bracelet producer, executive producer Jess Vander.
Thank you, Joey.
Oh, thanks, Aaron.
And also thanks, Chris Pratt.
I'd like to thank Logan for saving those kids.
I'd like to thank Marsha P. Johnson for just being an amazing activist.
I'd like to thank Logan for his pecs.
I'd like to thank the Vixen for actually coming out and saying to RuPaul what she needed to hear on that reunion for season 10. That was right.
I'd like to thank Matt Damon for being a New England sports homer.
I would also like to thank Honey Davenport for coming out against the monster that was also on point, girl. You better go get it.
And finally, I think we'd like to thank ConCon. I hope that they steal so much this year.
So much.
Special guest at ConCon is Donald Trump. Okay, bye.